From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Rebecca Shear. This episode, how do you keep kids safe during the summertime? Washington, D.C. and other cities are renovating their playgrounds to increase safety for children at play.
Because kids, you know, they'll climb this rock, they'll jump. So that's what they're designed to do, so we want to make sure that the surface is safe.
But are kids then missing out on the challenges of playtime? Then,
calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat?
How this one song became the protest anthem of a generation. And on the other end of the music spectrum, author Nathan Rabin started listening to Phish and Insane Clown Posse as a sort of anthropological experiment.
They kind of have a reputation as the most hated band in the world.
But then he got sucked into the music. And speaking of music...
So, do you agree with Kevin?
About what?
Am I really cute?
A new musical takes us through the trials and tribulations of a first date.
You said you were an open book. Well, am I?
That's all on this week's podcast, so listen up and enjoy.
She's hip and cool. She's just like all those girls that ignored me all through school. She's kind of indie.
It's summertime, and that means no school. Kids can play, explore, and climb all day long, which means an added challenge for parents who want to keep their kids out of harm's way. In the past few years, major cities like New York and Philadelphia have been renovating playgrounds to make them safer, so kids can play hard and their parents can rest easy.
We're standing at the Palisades Recreation Center in the Palisades neighborhood of Washington, D.C.
Jesus Aguirre is director of the D.C. Department of Parks and Recreation. We met him at one of the several dozen city playgrounds slated for major renovations. This one is still under construction. Looking around, I asked Aguirre about how his department designed this playground to be safer, yet still challenging and fun for the kids.
Yeah, no, that's the challenge. Obviously, our goal is to get children outdoors, exploring, and on some level, taking risks, right? Climbing and doing things like that. The approach to safety has to do with the way, from the very beginning, how we design the playground from the ground up. Because kids, you know, they'll climb this rock, they'll jump. That's what they're designed to do. So we want to make sure that the surface is safe. You notice the swing space here looks pretty separated from everything else. Obviously, you want to have enough room so that the kids are swinging and, you know, they're going to jump and you want to make sure there's enough room there.
I'm seeing some really interesting equipment on this playground that, quite frankly, I never saw when I was a child on a playground. Can you talk about some of the particular features?
So we wanted to move away from sort of the typical play structures, the swings, and just the slides, which are important. But we wanted to create spaces that look natural but are much safer and are going to be around for a really long time. So you look at these rocks, they look very realistic, but that's glass fiber reinforced concrete. So, you know, it's not going to crumble, it's not going to fall apart, it'll be there for 50 years. There's some folks who argue that our playgrounds are getting too safe. Certainly when I was younger, there was a lot more sort of the standard metal monkey bars climbing structures that probably weren't as thoughtful in terms of safety and things like that. So we incorporate that, but obviously we make sure that we take advantage of all of the new, you know, research around safety and making sure that we're making them safe while balancing the need to have playgrounds really serve as learning opportunities, yeah, obviously physical and social and all of these other developmental aspects that we really aim to achieve here.
One of those researchers works as the director of the Injury Free Coalition in Rochester, New York. Ann Brayer sees kids come in every day with minor and major injuries, and she's even helped build a safer playground in Rochester. I asked her what's wrong with the old school metal jungle gyms and seesaws that, well, I grew up with.
Well, they're different things. I think probably the number one thing is the surface on which it's built. So old playgrounds were just built on grass, specifically for swings and climbers. If kids fall from any kind of height, they can be pretty seriously injured. So putting state-of-the-art rubberized cushioning or wood mulch that's thick enough will really prevent a lot of injuries. Likewise, some of the deaths that have occurred on playgrounds happen from strangulation.
So things like jungle gyms?
Jungle gyms, monkey bars, climbers of any sort are a particular concern.
So then what kinds of equipment are we seeing in these newer playgrounds that will prevent these things from happening?
They have protective surfaces so that burns are much less likely. Slides tend to be the tunnel slides so that it's less likely for kids to fall off of them. playgrounds nowadays are designed for specific ages in mind, and that's usually posted at the playground, just so families at least are aware that their two-year-old may not be all that safe playing on the equipment that's designed for eight-year-olds.
You know, part of going outside on playgrounds and playing is the thrill it gives children.
That's true.
So I want to ask your opinion on this. Is there such a thing as being too safe in terms of equipment, dumbing down the equipment so that there's not as much thrill and exhilaration from playing?
Yes, certainly you could make play equipment that is so safe that it's no fun to play on. But I think it's still possible to have lots of fun on current playgrounds. You just need to think a little bit outside the box.
But does the child lose anything from playing it too safe? Kathy Hirsch-Pasek is a professor of psychology at Temple University, and she says sometimes, yes.
Look, I don't mind changing from wood to plastic, but I do think that we have to let kids climb a little bit higher because we learn a tremendous amount from getting that skin knee. And we become successes not just by succeeding, but sometimes by failing.
What about those who say that our children's safety is the most important thing, as in, you know, sometimes it's more than a skinned knee or a bruised elbow?
Well, I think throughout time, we've had to be very careful that children didn't touch hot stoves and that they don't pretend to be Superman and jump off roofs. And we have to parent here and regulate that they don't do those things because they really aren't safe. On the other hand, I think we have to find the right balance. And being in a penned environment maybe isn't the right balance. Maybe we still need to let children climb those trees because they're learning a lot by climbing them and they're getting a lot of confidence while they do.
So parents have to sort of walk a fine line between keeping an eye on their children's safety, but then also being helicopter parents. How do they manage that?
Well, it's often not easy. But, you know, we have to think in the long range, what kind of society do we want? And what kind of children do we want to raise in that society? We're hearing a lot of news today, especially from corporate America, that we want innovators. That means we have to be adaptive. We have to be flexible. And we have to learn how to take those challenges.
That was Kathy Hirsch-Pasek of Temple University. So enjoy those monkey bars and have a fun summer. We move now from the playground to the parking lot, or the bathroom, or a building, anywhere really that you see that familiar symbol showing the profile of a person in a wheelchair, the handicap sign.
You'll notice in the old International Symbol of Access, the posture of the figure is unnaturally erect in the chair. There's something very mechanical about that.
Sarah Hendren is a graduate design student at Harvard and a founder of the Accessible Icon Project. The original handicap sign dates back to 1968, and Hendren has helped create a brand new one, one that's more active, more dynamic, with the person wheeling him or herself independently.
Ours is also leaning forward in the chair. There's a clear sense of movement, self-navigation through the world.
That might not seem like much of a difference, but Hendren tells us it completely changed the life of a man she met when the project first began.
A young man named Brendan Hildreth, who soon after we did this community service day together, Brendan moved with his family to North Carolina. He has become a kind of one-man machine down there around this symbol. So he made T-shirts with his family. He's invited local businesses and institutions to change their signage.
As Hendren tells it, Hildreth, who has cerebral palsy and speaks through a machine, had a unique perspective.
He's someone who has been treated as though he had less of a complex and interesting life and wishes for his future. And as a result of using the icon, he's had all this opportunity to say in public speeches and to newspapers, this is what I want. What I want is what everybody else wants. I want an education. I want work that I love. And I want to not be treated as somebody who needs extra help in a particular kind of flattened way.
That perception was what drew Sarah Hendren and her partner, Brian Glennie, an assistant professor at Gordon College, to start the Accessible Icon Project in the first place. And it didn't hurt that Glennie also happens to dabble in graffiti art.
And he said, well, why don't we do something? He was used to kind of altering public property.
So the pair trekked all over Boston, putting up stickers of the new symbol side by side with the existing one. Of course, technically, Hendren and Glennie were defacing public property, which happens to be illegal.
That's right, to put a fine point on it. But we were glad that we did, because we raised some conversation. I mean, some people thought this was a kind of frivolous exercise, but many more people said, we see what you're doing, we want to talk more about this. And we sent stickers to people all over the country.
They soon caught the attention of the Disability Commissioner for New York City. And already this summer, the new symbol has been replacing old signs in all five boroughs. It's even unofficially been popping up in cities around the world. Sarah Hendren says there are those who've asked, why bother changing things? Isn't it just an icon? And she's ready with an answer.
An icon, an image, a symbol can be a really powerful kind of seed for much larger efforts and find ways to talk about our perceptions about each other, about difference.
Sarah Hendren is a graduate student of design at Harvard University. You can see the new accessible icon at accessibleicon.org in New York City. And who knows, maybe soon, somewhere near you. This is an old Yiddish folk song. So old, it goes back 100 years to the Jewish towns, or in Yiddish, the shtetls of Ukraine. The song is still around today thanks to a Russian Jewish writer who set out to document all of Jewish culture in the early 1900s. And now, singers Michael Alpert and Ethel Rame are working to preserve this song and others.
It's saying right.
Well, I was privileged to grow up speaking Yiddish. Most of my family, my parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. And I've always been fascinated with the world that my parents and my family came out of. I've been speaking and singing Yiddish since I was pretty much since before I can remember.
Well, I guess like Michael, you know, I grew up with singing this music as well as some other East European music, and I was 3 years old when I was put on a table and asked to sing Binele, Binele. Binele, Binele, hop, 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 hop. It just has such profound meaning for me, and it really does sustain me. La 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 li la rum pum pum.
Anski was the pseudonym of Shlomo Zandel Rapoport, who was the father of East European Jewish ethnography, was really the first person to begin collecting East European Jewish, and it was Yiddish folklore, tales, music, what we call material cultures. We are part of a larger movement that's been going on for almost the last 40 years of a revival of East European Jewish, often known as klezmer music, Yiddish song, which is a very closely related genre, and Yiddish culture in general. This, I guess it's important to see it in the light of the Second World War and the near destruction of the East European Jewish world. But we often these days talk about Yiddish land, which is not a particular piece of territory, but it is all the places in the world where Yiddish culture survives and continues and is both preserved and renewed and reinvented in a contemporary existence. Dann schön singen, tit mir stark der Barmen. It's not a music that's very familiar in terms of what people think of as Yiddish or East European Jewish music today, but this is the real old-time stuff. In meinem Reben erso leben, is gewein a gitter Shabbos, zu dek od gehobt schirayim, mit beide Labbos. Oh,
Ei, et siget sin motsode, fylls av alle bisken grode, oi, vei, es mir tatte jo. Oi, et siget sin motsode, fylls av alle bisken grode, oi, vei, es mir adora.
Oh, it would be very, very sad if this music had no future. It's such a fantastic repertoire, and I think it puts people very much in touch with deep places within themselves that, you know, in contemporary life, we don't have that many opportunities. And I think that's really, really important. You know, I sing when I walk up my five flights to my loft. I sing in elevators. It's tunes are constantly going in my head. And the music is just very, very meaningful to me.
To me, these songs, they express everything that's in life and in our lives. Even though they may be very old songs, they have a tremendous emotional content. They are new and meaningful to those of us that sing them. They express what's inside us, and that's the traditional aesthetic of these songs.
Michael Alpert and Ethel Rame, along with cymbalist Pete Ruszewski and violinist Jake Schulman-Ment. Together, they make up the Onsky Yiddish Heritage Ensemble.
Me to wear a mask.
The men you seek think you are dead, Kimosabe. Better to stay that way.
The Lone Ranger opened this weekend, featuring a heavily made-up Johnny Depp as Tonto, replete with war paint and a dead crow as a headdress. And when you consider some of Johnny Depp's past film roles, like Edward Scissorhands and Willy Wonka, could it be he's the actor who's logged the most time in a makeup chair in Hollywood?
I'd say that's probably pretty accurate.
That's makeup artist Joel Harlow, one of Depp's frequent collaborators. They met on the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
And I've worked with him on every pirate film since then.
As well as Alice in Wonderland.
Dark Shadows.
The Tourist.
The Rum Diary.
And, of course, their latest partnership.
Lone Ranger.
Justice is what I seek, Kimosabe.
Joel Harlow's worked with plenty of other actors, too, but he says a partnership like this one comes from a place of respect.
One of the things that I appreciate about Johnny is he doesn't shy away from makeup, you know, even extreme makeup or prosthetic makeup. it's basically a philosophy of whatever it takes to create the character.
How would you describe the relationship between the makeup artist and the actor? I would imagine things get rather intimate.
Well, I mean, I can only speak about our relationship, but it is. It's very collaborative. He's very fluent in the art of makeup. He could probably do the job himself. I'm just fortunate enough that he has me doing it. But when we're creating a character, it's very collaborative.
Well, as I understand it, Johnny Depp had a definite idea of how he wanted Tonto to look in this new reboot of the Lone Ranger franchise. How did you two go about partnering up on achieving that look?
Yeah, that went back to, we were filming The Rum Diary in Puerto Rico, and I was pulling images for this carnival sequence. And I had him sitting in the trailer, so when he came in, he saw these images sitting out, and one of these images was a copy of this Kirby Sattler painting, I Am Crow, which is basically that look. It's sort of the white, you know, war paint with the black stripes. And he pulled that aside and he said, let's hold on to this because this might be a good look for Tonto. At which time I said, well, you know, you want to test it? I could start sculpting nose prosthetics, whatever we need, get wigs made, build a bird, you know, and we can put this thing together and take some photos. And that's ultimately what we did on a weekend. And based on those pictures, that's sort of what re-sparked getting this film made.
Did you have any apprehension, though, about turning what's basically a white guy into a Native American, knowing it was bound to offend someone?
Well, he's not a white guy, though. I mean, he has Native American blood in him, you know, and he's an actor. You know, creating a character, I mean, you can't worry about offending people because what we're doing is fantasy. So, no, I mean, I wasn't worried about offending anybody. I just wanted to deliver, as an artist, the best version of this character, you know, from my end that I possibly could. And I think we achieved that.
Looking back at your years in Hollywood, you have a long list of accomplishments. Any favorite stories from the biz that stand out in your mind?
You know, I do a little teaching every now and then, and one that I kind of tell my students is one of the first films I was working on in Florida, I had sculpted these arms for this creature that was like, you know, he's like a melting guy. And the arms came up to maybe mid-forearm, me thinking that, okay, he's going to be wearing a long-sleeve shirt. Turns out he's in a tank top.
Oh, no.
And these things stop. They don't blend off. It's, you know, it's an incomplete illusion. But fortunately, they were sculpted to look kind of like peanut butter and jelly. So I ran over to craft service and grabbed, you know, some of the peanut butter and jelly and smeared it on him. And, you know, we got the shot and it ended up working.
Please tell me what movie that was. I want to add it to my Netflix queue.
I don't even think it's out. I don't think it was even released. I was just so excited to be making monsters and creating characters. And it, no matter, I was like sleeping on a floor in a warehouse in Florida. And, you know, it's 1,000 degrees. But it's like we didn't care. We were making monsters. We were doing what we wanted to do, what we always wanted to do. So,
living the dream.
Yeah, living the dream. I have a different dream now.
You have a different dream.
doesn't involve sleeping on the floor.
Joel Harlow is the makeup department head for The Lone Ranger, which opened this weekend. He's worked with Johnny Depp on about 12 films over the years, including the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. Joel Harlow, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Fans of the television show Chuck fell in love with the title character, an average computer whiz next door who had the CIA's greatest spy secrets encoded in his brain. But these days, Chuck star Zachary Levi is up to something a little bit different.
She's a little artsy. She's hip and cool. She's just like all those girls that ignored me all through school.
Zach Levi is rehearsing for his first role on Broadway in a new musical comedy called First Date. And who is Zach dating, at least on stage? That'd be Broadway veteran Krista Rodriguez, who also appeared on TV in the musical drama series Smash.
He's a bit annoying and overdressed. He's got the kind of eye that says, look at me, I'm stressed.
Nutshelled, First Date is about a blind date that seems to go cringingly wrong. But there aren't just two people up there on stage enduring all those awkward pauses. They bring with them all sorts of baggage from past relationships. And those voices in their heads make up a kind of Greek chorus. I joined Zach Levi and Krista Rodriguez in New York just after a rehearsal, and I asked them why the concept of a first date makes such great fodder for a musical theater.
We joke about certain keywords, but it is very relatable. It's this thing that, you know, that anybody in, well, almost anybody can look at and go, oh, I understand what's going on there.
Yeah.
Because if you've been on a first date, that's it. And when, you know, my first date, I was 12. You were what? My mom came with me. You know what I'm saying?
I'm like, what?
The look on his face.
Yeah, no, about that or whatever. Yeah, it's like when you're going out, but you're not going out. Like whatever that middle school thing is of like,
well, you go out. Like someone. If you've done that moment, this show is relatable.
It's relatable. All the things that we talk about in the date, from past experiences and exes to, you know, politics and religion and the things, although I guess maybe not everybody gets to that on a first date. I try to. I try to rip the Band-Aid off. That's how I do things. Excuse me, but
two questions
for you. But it's a really fun evening.
It's a madcap evening
that has mostly funny, but a lot of heart as well. And hope, and, you know, and like two people in this crazy world that may or may not click, but maybe they do, but maybe they don't, but maybe they do, and will they end up together? I don't know. I won't ruin it for you. You have to see the play.
And so many of the songs are so apropos to this crazy dating world today. We have the song about Google searching someone and doing a little Google research before the date, a song called Awkward Pause, which is pretty much perfect.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Better to bump into a hex
or catch a mild STD.
See your parents having sex
or watch an episode of Glee.
Things that normally are paralyzing, compared to this they all seem appetizing. 'Cause you're stuck in the agonizing pause of the awkward, the awkward.
So the musical takes place on a first date, but it's so much more than just two people sitting at a table. We have this sort of Greek chorus aspect going on. Can you talk about that?
Well, I guess in a real life first date, there's so much more than just the two people at the table. You have all of the things that you come to the table with, which are your past experiences and your fears and all of your weird habits. And so that's sort of what these people in the show represent.
Oh, come on, guys. You have no right to get in the middle of this.
We have every right to get in the middle of this, Casey.
But your past
and your future, love.
You guys satisfied a very specific need at a very specific time in my life, but fortunately those days are over.
You only think that they're over.
You like bad boys, Casey, not this.
They become the voices in our heads or the things that keep people from getting together.
I never open up your door. I never shower you with praise. When you call or text my phone, I don't reply to you for days.
Though we have the lion's share of the dialogue,
they have the hard job
because they're doing quick change.
Let's not sell ourselves short. I mean, we're working pretty hard.
Are we? No, we are. We are. It's hard. Broadway's hard.
I tried to warn him.
It's going to get hard when we have 8 shows a week, which is something I know nothing about. And
yeah, Zach, let's talk about that. This is your Broadway debut. How did you even get involved with the production?
There had been some names kicked around when they knew they were bringing it to Broadway, and somebody had brought up my name, and I was almost in Young Frankenstein, but then Chuck got picked up, the pilot got picked up, and I went and had to do the show. So those that knew, kind of in the Broadway circles, knew, oh, that guy who's never done Broadway almost did Broadway.
And wants to do Broadway.
And part of that was
The mistake of telling me that they had thought that he might want to do it, and I emailed him and told him he should do it.
Yeah. So this girl who I had met very briefly, like she had tested for a pilot I was doing like a year prior.
I was going to say, did you have a long history together?
No, not at all. About 2 hours of history.
Yeah.
And then a year later, they said, we're thinking about offering it to, or we have offered it to this guy. And I was like, well,
let me do the work. So I found his email and I sent him an email and said, I don't know if you remember me, but I think you should do this. And didn't hear from him for 2 weeks.
It was 10 days.
13 days. We looked it up.
I think it was 9 days.
13 days.
It was a week.
We looked it up.
And but she did, and that you know, and I don't know, you kind of take note of things that happen. I'm a spiritual guy, and I believe that, you know, that things kind of come at you in certain ways, and you should take note of it. And so I took note of that, and, you know, meditating on that and thinking about it really hard and talking to God and being like, hey, man, is this it? Is this what I'm supposed to do? I've always wanted to live in New York. I always wanted to do Broadway. And I just had an overwhelming peace, and I was like, yeah, this is it. I'm going to do that. I'm going to go move to New York. I'm going to go live in a city I've never lived in that's 3,000 miles away after living my entire life in Southern California and perfect weather.
And it was like 2 weeks too.
And now
like,
I don't own enough linen. I don't know how to get through the humidity. This is crazy. What is going
on? He's so jealous of my sundresses.
I am very jealous. Men need a version of the sundress. I don't know what that is. Just something that's breathable and also has many applications. I could be casual,
he was jealous
but also
of all
at a dinner party, whatever.
The guys at the Pride weekend. He was like, they have it so easy. They can wear whatever they want.
I love that the two of you didn't know each other well before you started this process, because as with the characters, they're meeting for the first time, and
yeah,
you have to sort of build up this chemistry, see what it's like. So what has that been like, getting to know each other personally, but also Aaron and Casey undergoing this, you know, hour and a half long date?
Well, that was always, you know, people will talk about how our chemistry is really great, and then we're sort of like, well, maybe we should temper that a little bit, because we're not actually supposed,
we're
to,
not supposed to
like
actually
each other that much,
yeah,
for a while, at least. And but,
well, I'm supposed to like you. Really, you're
you
the one who's screwing it up.
And
yeah, that's true.
You know, a little uncool.
But Aaron could pretty much deal with whatever. Yeah. He's like, you're hot. I'm fine. Let's go.
Yeah, that's
Let's
true. Guys are generally like that. I always joke that women are always like, oh, he's talking to me. And guys are always like, is this going to happen? Like, all the time.
Krista Rodriguez and Zachary Levi are the stars of the new Broadway musical, First Date. So when does the show open and where can we see it?
We start previews July 9th, and then we open August 8th at the Long Acre Theater on 48th Street.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you once unafraid wore your heart on your sleeve, and the ones that you love chose to just turn and leave, every day it gets harder to somehow believe you will survive, so you strive just to keep up your guard, 'cause it's safer to hold every card. Oh, it's safer to hold every card. I feel out of control, I feel safe on the ground. I go building up walls, yet I wish to be found. A true contradiction to which I am bound. I keep on spinning around and around, and I look at the people who've worked it all out, and I wonder why I'm still a bundle of doubt. And sometimes I wanna just stand up and shout, just commit and deal with it before your life flies by. Don't let your life fly by. But is it safer? Maybe it's safer if I don't try. For
most of us, beach food probably means things like hot dogs, hamburgers, and lemonade on the boardwalk. But visit the East Matunic State Beach in Rhode Island, and the food of choice is oysters. From the Matunic Oyster Bar, a small restaurant down the street, we visited owner and oyster farmer Perry Rasso and brought back this audio postcard.
My name is Perry Rasso. I'm from Matunic Oyster Farm and Matunic Oyster Bar. I started a small shellfish farm. After a few years, I expanded to 4-acre farm, and now I'm at a 7-acre farm. In 2009, I purchased the restaurant, and it became popular, and we were voted the best new restaurant in Rhode Island, and it's a lot of work and a lot of good people helping. We're in Potter Pond in South Kingstown, Rhode Island, the southern part of Rhode Island. Potter Pond is a salt pond, an estuary, with an inlet from the Atlantic Ocean. This pond is actually the deepest salt pond in Rhode Island. It was formed by a glacier thousands of years ago. So the farm starts right here. It's on the other side of that salt marsh is the dunes and the barrier beach, East Matunuck State Beach. We're coming up to right now rows of oyster bags, much like rows of corn or vegetables at a vegetable farm. There's rows of oysters in these sturdy plastic mesh bags. Some of the bags that are standing up are getting ready to be put back in the lines to lay parallel with the sea floor. They're suspended from the sea floor with PVC plastic racks, and there's roughly 10,000 bags of oysters. I first started digging shellfish when I was in junior high. I snuck behind some summer homes in the pond and started digging little net clams and making, you know, 30, 40 bucks cash at the end of the day. I started scuba diving for them. Went away to college and studied aquaculture and fisheries technology at URI. And I started the farm and then gradually expanded it. So I'm going to jump in right now. Here you can see a bag of oysters. The top of the bag has got algae on it. Bottom of the bag, not as much. We stock the oysters. We start them at about 1,500 oysters per bag. And then as they get larger, they graduate into larger bags. And you can see the new growth of the oyster is the edge of the oyster is called the cuticle. It's the clear, and it's very soft. And one of the things we do to kind of create a better product is break that cuticle off by shaking the bag of oysters. It breaks that cuticle off. It slows the growth down a little bit, but it makes a thicker shell and a more uniform shape of oyster. It also cleans some of the biofouling off the oysters. But you can see in the bag the size discrepancy. They grow at different rates. The oysters are sold as the individual, by the piece. So the first bag we pulled up was about 1,200 oysters. When we first stock them, 1,500 oysters in a bag. When I first started, I would open bags that had giant starfish in it and a bunch of dead oysters. I had this big starfish get in the bag. And what happened was it got in the bag when it was little and small enough to move through the mesh and made a whole living on eating the oysters and then became a giant starfish. But now we maintain our gear better so that doesn't happen. You could spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week out here. And the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. The more you maintain the oysters, the better they'll survive and the better they'll grow.
That was oyster farmer Perry Rasso of the Matunuck Oyster Farm in Rhode Island. Back in 2009, on a warm December night in Miami, a pop culture writer named Nathan Rabin walked into an arena to see a concert. For Rabin, it was the start of a two-year adventure as he followed around two of music's most divisive groups, this jam band, Phish, and a rap duo known as Insane Clown Posse. In time, Rabin would come to love both.
But that first weekend, I held on to cynicism like a life preserver. I thought I needed it. I thought I needed my defenses. Time would prove me wrong. I wouldn't get anything of value out of my travels until I let myself go, until I abandoned a detached, critical perspective and made a conscious decision to lose myself in the moment.
That's Nathan Rabin reading from his new book titled You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me. He says his motivation was partly anthropological, as he sought to document both groups' famously rabid fans. But it was also a personal pursuit, inspired by, as he writes in his book, a girl with a history of Phish fandom. So for Rabin, coming to love Phish, who some call the spiritual heir to the Grateful Dead's hippie following, well, that was one thing. But coming to love Insane Clown Posse, that was something else altogether. Insane Clown Posse hails from Detroit and performs a kind of hardcore hip-hop known as horrorcore. ICP's fans are called Juggalos, and the Juggalos adore Insane Clown Posse, so much so that two of ICP's albums have gone platinum. But as Nathan Rabin points out, ICP's fans are way outnumbered by haters.
They have a reputation as the most hated band in the world.
But as abrasive as Insane Clown Posse can be, Rabin told me that by the end of his 2 years on the road, he'd come around.
One of the many joyous surprises of writing this book is I came to really enjoy their music.
on a deep, unironic level. I mean, it's fun, it's enjoyable. There's this really goofy, really wild, really offbeat sense of humor that I really, really like, respond to. There's also this kind of deification and this romanticization of poverty, and a specific kind of poverty that I think is both really fun and refreshing, and also I think very liberating for poor kids who tend to be Insane Clown Posse's core demographic. If you grow up a latchkey kid and you come from a broken family and you don't have anything, you know, you can't really relate to the Jay-Z's of the world, but, you know, Insane Clown Posse, they kind of make it seem cool to be poor and reviled and, you know, one of the scrubs of life. And that, I think, is really, really appealing, and not just to kids and weirdos and outcasts the world over, but I think also to me while I was writing this book.
I want to hear more about the Phish fans.
Yeah, there are a lot of different kinds of Phish fans. I think, you know, definitely going into the book, I had my own kind of preconceptions. I already had my own kind of stereotypes. And over the process of writing this book, I think one of the things that made the journey that I went through was about rejecting irony and rejecting cynicism and rejecting snark. For example, the first year that I followed Phish, this was in 2010, I followed them for 8, 10, 12 shows, and I didn't get anything out of it. There was like this barrier between me and this world that I wanted to be a part of, but I just didn't know my way in. And I remember looking at people dancing to, say, Boogie On Reggae Woman, which is a cover they do of a Stevie Wonder song. And I remember the first time I heard it, just thinking like, oh, this is just embarrassing. Like, middle-aged white men should not cover a song called Boogie on Reggae Woman. But the second year that I followed Phish, when I kind of let all that irony, when I let all that critical distance go, I just found it to be unbelievably joyous. And I would look at people dancing at Phish shows and just feel like these are people who are overcome with joy and feel the need to express it. And it's both reductive and insulting and, you know, doing violence to the human spirit to look at that and just judge it and not just feel that sense of joy that permeates Phish shows.
On the flip side, Insane Clown Posse, there are bright things, but also there's a dark side to Insane Clown Posse. It's a group that's been associated with a lot of violence. You recount some of that in the book. Can you tell us what that was like?
A lot of the Insane Clown Posse's imagery is very dark, is very disturbing, is very violent. But the overall message of it is to lead a good life and to be good to your fellow person and to love thy fellow juggalo. And, you know, at the heart of it is basically this fundamental Judeo-Christian mythology. To live a good life and you go to heaven, which they call Shangri-La, be a bad person, exploit other people, rip off the poor, then you go to hell's pit. And at the gathering, there is a confrontational aspect. And there's always that capacity at the gathering that something really dark will happen. And that if the rules of man are suspended for 4 or 5 days, as they often are, bad things will happen. But I think bad things are going to happen at any festival, especially a festival where there are 14,000 people, like very little oversight, very little security. But there's also a lot of light at the gathering. You know, there are also a lot of people who are just having the most ecstatic time of their life. There are also people who have really difficult, really painful lives who, like, you know, for 360 days, being a juggalo makes them an outcast and makes them reviled and makes them a pariah. And for 4 or 5 days of the year, being a juggalo makes them, you know, the king of the world. And everybody loves them. And Insane Clown Posse is the most popular group in the world. It's this alternate universe they can escape into from, you know, the dreariness and the mundanity of everyday life. And I feel like that's something that Phish and Insane Clown Posse both offer, is this possibility for transcendence that is very rare in our culture.
That's pop culture critic Nathan Rabin. He's the author of the new book called You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, about his years following the bands Phish and Insane Clown Posse. Thanks so much for joining us, Nathan.
Thank you so much.
Fifty years ago, here in the U.S., protesters were taking to the streets. Philadelphia and Harlem saw race riots. Atlantic City saw picketers screaming outside the Democratic National Convention. In Washington, D.C., anti-war activists took over the National Mall. And the soundtrack to it all was one song, Martha and the Vandellas' 1964 hit, Dancing in the Street. In New York City, in that all we need is you. Mark Kurlansky has written a new history of that protest anthem, which, he says, has spread like wildfire through the music industry and been covered by dozens of bands.
Van Halen. Everly Brothers. A summer is here and the time is right for dancing. Ramsey Lewis did my favorite cover of it. He did, you know, it's a jazz trio, and it just completely turned the thing inside out. Michael Bolton, Neil Diamond, not one of my favorite ones. French and Finnish and Danish. It's just a great song that everybody wants to do, but not that easy to pull off. In fact, the only recordings that have made it into the top 10 was the original, Martha and the Vandellas, and Mick Jagger and David Bowie. Which is a recording that everybody either loves or hates. South America, Australia, France, Germany, UK, Africa.
Well, in your book, you propose that "Dancing in the Streets" was an iconic song of the summer of 1964, an anthem, as you say in your title. And as we know, that summer was a pretty turbulent time in American politics. We saw the arrests of civil rights demonstrators, the burning of black churches, not to mention everything that was happening with the United States and Vietnam. And yet today, I'm sure people listen to the song, and many of them would just say, it's a pop hit, it's a party song. So I'm curious, how did the tune become the protest song of that summer back in the 60s?
Well, I think the key to the history of this song is that it's a song that inspires you. It makes you feel like doing something. and so it all depends on what it is you want to do. And that summer when it came out, it was released July 31st, 2 days before the Vietnam War began, during the height of the civil rights movement's Mississippi Freedom Summer. So it was a time that begged for meanings.
So do you think its original legacy is lost, then, that idea of it being a protest song?
I went and tried to watch all of the movies that have used it. Now, there's this Whoopi Goldberg movie, Sister Act 2, which, you know, it's not a film that's often brought up in serious discussions of cinema. But there's an interesting moment. She plays this Vegas singer who's hiding out as a nun, and she's trying to raise money for a glee club. She goes out on the street in San Francisco, and to raise money for the glee club, she sings Dancing in the Street. It doesn't matter what you wear, just as long as you are there. So come on, every guy, every girl, everywhere, around the world. And that's exactly right. You know, this is a song that gets people on their feet, and it can be used for whatever you want. It can be used for black power. It can be used for feminism. It can be used to raise money for a glee club because it just inspires people.
Mark Kurlansky's new book is called Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
My pleasure.
For the week ending July 7th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Becky Sullivan, Liz Baker, Amy Held, and Priska Neely. Our interns are Rachel Rood and Jan Stort. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Rebecca Shear. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.